we'd like a word.
About writing history as fiction. You're listening to We'd Like a Word with me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colgan.
And our special guest is a writer with only one name, Amish.
Hey, how are you doing, Paul? How are you doing, Steve?
Amish is the author of, is it 12?
10 books.
10 books? Only 10, oh well, not so impressive. 10
order.
This has got off to a friendly start.
Don't get in touch with my publisher.
Okay.
10 books, and they're kind of based on the history of India, and the latest one, which I've just been enjoying reading, is called War of Lanka, and it's the fourth book in the Ramchandra series. And you have a number of distinctions, one of which is having the fastest selling series of fiction in India, I think. Is it this one?
No, it's my other one, Shiva Trilogy. Ramchandra series is, from what my publisher has told me, sadly, the second fastest selling.
Oh, he's been beaten by himself.
it's not bad, though, when you get beaten by yourself, is it?
Yeah.
I couldn't get number one because I was already number one.
I was just thinking what we should ask you, and I was thinking people who came to mind, Beyonce, Madonna, Shakira, Prince, Mayawati in India, Masaba, and Amish, people who are so famous that they just go by one name, their first name.
My God, what a question. Okay.
Are you the Indian Beyonce?
I'm male, first of all, and I do identify as male. Sorry.
Oh, he's been saved. Difficult question. He's been saved by some tea arriving.
It's the tea man.
Thank you very much. I should say that we're inside the Nehru Centre, which is the preeminent Indian cultural institution in the UK.
I know, and it's rather grand, isn't it?
It's very grand, and they give us tea.
It's all high ceilings and plaster mouldings and beautiful portraits on the walls and sort of dark wood desks. And I feel like I should be probably with the builders outside. I feel it's all a bit upmarket for me.
Well, you'll not be surprised to hear that as soon as we came in, Steve started rearranging the chairs. Wrecking the place just like the British did to India.
That's a bit harsh.
Why? I don't know if Amish would agree.
Honest but harsh. All right, but coming back. Prince, I'm a huge fan of his, but from what I remember, I don't think he went by Prince anymore, right? It was just a symbol. The artist formerly known as Prince. I'm just one name. And mine isn't as deep an insight for why I guess Prince or Beyonce, etc. may not have their... Beyonce is a singer, if I'm not mistaken. May not have their surname.
Oh, he's pretending he doesn't know who Beyonce is.
I'm an Indian. All right. But I don't use my surname for a simple reason. My surname is a caste surname. I'm against the caste system the way it exists today. So, and obviously my passport, driving license has to have my full name. But I thought on my book, maybe I will be true to what I believe in. So don't look at where I was born. Look at my own karma. That is my own name.
Good answer.
It is. Very good answer. Sting didn't do that, did he? Otherwise he'd be called Sunderland, wouldn't he?
Sting, there's another one.
Oh, no,
Sting.
He wouldn't admit. I've just admitted he came from Sunderland. Oh, no, I've just given the game away for Sting.
Well, his first wife.
His surname is Sunderland.
No, it's Sumner. Sumner. He's called Gordon Sumner, isn't it? I think it is.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He's not actually called Sting. Who knew?
No, that was obvious that wasn't his name, but I didn't know his surname, actually.
Yeah, Sumner.
Yeah, but he's a brilliant...
He used to be a teacher, didn't he, years ago?
He used to be a teacher, and he was married to someone from Belfast.
Oh, yes,
but not anymore.
Yeah, not anymore, no. No, it's Trudy Styler now, isn't it, I think? Yes, yes.
This is a very educational podcast. We learn
all sorts of things. Particularly about music.
Yes. But getting back to War of Lanka, tell us about it. What is it about?
Look,
for fans of Beyonce who haven't heard of you,
okay.
Tell us
which
what this is.
Which would be like a gazillion people. But I'm assuming most in the world would have heard of this term, Happy Diwali. It's what many usually wish Indians and Hindus. And Diwali is called the Festival of Lights. But many don't know where that festival originated from. It actually, one of the legends behind it, is it's from the story of the Ramayana, which is an ancient Indian epic, where Lord Ram, the god, fought a battle with a quote-unquote demon called Ravan, who had kidnapped his wife, goddess Sita. And he fought that battle, defeated Ravan, freed his wife, and then the royal couple went back to their homeland to Ayodhya, and when they reached back, that was the first Diwali, because the citizens welcomed them back by lighting lamps and kind of, you know, welcoming the god. And that was the first Diwali, and hence the festival of lights and the victory of good over evil. That story is called the Ramayana. So my Ramchandra series is a modern interpretation of the Ramayana. Hence the story behind the Diwali.
So this is the fourth in the series. Yeah. And the first three are named after the main
characters. Yeah.
So Ram, Sita and Ravan.
Yeah.
So what happens? Well, there's a clue in the title, war. So what happens in this part of the series?
There is a war and it is in Lanka. Yeah.
Okay, Steve, over to you.
I was going to shout out when you said what happens. I was going to say no spoilers, but surely one of the difficulties in writing this sort of book, and you know, I'm saying no spoilers, is that the story is already out there. Mm-hmm. What do you do to put a new gloss or a new way of telling a story that already exists? Because people kind of already know what the ending is.
That is true. Look, I interpret a lot of the traditional tale. Even modern Indians, the version of the Ramayana that they are aware of is actually largely based on a 1980s television serial in India, which was hugely popular. Even the rerun of that television series, the 1980s television series, just 2 years back during the pandemic, gathered more viewership just in India than Game of Thrones did worldwide.
Right? Wow.
Yeah, that's how popular Ramayana is in India. Everyone wants to hear it again and again and again. But many modern Indians actually aren't aware of the truly ancient versions. So mine is drawn more from the ancient versions, where the world was a lot more nuanced. So Goddess Sita, for example, is a warrior. She's not like a docile damsel. So in my book, in my series, it's kind of written that way. The world is a lot more nuanced, it's shades of gray. But I put in my imagination into it as well. So in a way, it's kind of the familiar, but in a different way. And largely for the youth. Most of my readers are the youth. But it's been written in a way that even Westerners who may have absolutely no idea about the story, you don't need to know the traditional tales to understand my book. It's been written in that way.
It's interesting what you say about female characters. So in this one, the Sita, who is twice refuses to be rescued because she thinks there has to be this war for longer term strategic reasons. And there's another character, is she called Sursha?
Sursha.
And she's a fearsome warrior, and as we find out, and very brave. Is that unusual in the sorts of literature that Indian young people would usually be reading?
You know, seeing women as equal to men may be unusual if you read the Indian tales and traditions written in the last few centuries, which by Indian terms is relatively recent. If you see the truly ancient ones, actually it's not that new, because men and women were seen as equals in ancient times. There's a version of the Ramayana, a very ancient version called the Adbhut Ramayana, in which the main villain, Ravan, is killed by Goddess Sita, not by the god Lord Ram, right? Where she's a warrior in that, and it's a very ancient version. In ancient India, we had women who ruled in their own name, not as the wife of the king or the daughter of a king. They ruled in their own name, with their own seal. We had women who founded universities. We had women who were the equivalent of prophets and messiahs in ancient India. So ancient India was actually a lot more egalitarian, not just for women, even for LGBTs, etc. We lost a lot of that during the periods of the invasions. I think the time has come to revive that.
When you say invasions, what do you mean?
There were foreign invaders who came to India in the last few centuries. Among them were the British. And many of them had their own versions of morality. They saw us as kind of too free and too in love with the erotic and other things. That's how they saw us. Because we ancient Indians didn't really see sex as the original sin. It's not something to be obsessed by. It's not something to see as an original sin either. It's just one part of life, that's all. In various other ways, we didn't have a concept of one truth or one God, for example. There's no concept of false gods. You know, every path is true from their own perspective, as long as you don't force your path on someone else. We had atheism in ancient India. There was no attacks on them. There were various philosophical schools in ancient India which were atheist schools. And this way of life was seen as not dissimilar to, say, how maybe the Pharaonic Egyptians or the Greco-Romans were seen when they were attacked, when the pagans were attacked. And Indians kind of absorbed many of these things that the invaders told us about us. You know, that we saw women as equal, so therefore maybe we were effete. You know, and we absorbed many of these. Also, I think any society which goes through a lot of random violence tends to become more patriarchal. It happens. But it's one of the arguments I've made in India repeatedly. We've been free for 75 years. We are a relatively peaceful society. It's time to give up the ways of our invaders and rediscover our own true self, which is actually deeply liberal.
So it's really interesting because there seems to be a sort of, I wouldn't say a vogue, but there's an old saying, isn't there, about history is written by the victors, mm-hmm. Or the dominators. And it's been, as you say, a very patriarchal society all across the world for a long time. And we're starting to see now a lot more fiction, which is not rewriting the old stories we know, but trying to reset the stories in a more balanced and more nuanced way, as you say. I mean, Natalie Haynes has been doing some great stuff with the old Greek myths. There's a lot of stuff at the moment trying to overturn the fact that almost anything that's been written in the last 200 years that is about paganism, people who believe in the old gods or witchcraft and things like that, has always been negative. It's always been a very negative thing. We're starting to see a lot of fiction now that's showing that in a much more positive light. It's a very positive move, I think, you know, getting that more balanced view.
And Steve, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying our way of life was perfect. There were faults in our way of life too. Otherwise, we wouldn't have lost to the invaders, right? But I think one of the things that often gets forgotten when people look at India is that we're the only pre-Bronze Age culture that is still alive. Every other pre-Bronze Age culture is dead. It's a museum piece, right? Pharaonic Egypt, Mycenae, which was the believed to be the mother culture of the Greeks and then the Greco-Romans, or Gilgamesh, Mesopotamia, they're all museum pieces now, sadly, right? India is still a living culture. We still chant hymns that were composed 7,000, 8,000 years ago. Imagine if, like, the worshippers of Zeus and Apollo were still alive. And they are relatively young gods, right, for Indians. But our stories kept evolving. So
I suppose Zoroastrians, they're still going.
Yeah, you're right. But Zoroastrians in their own homeland are actually practically gone. They're alive in India, actually, because they were given refuge in India in the 7th, 8th century when they were pushed out and suffered ethnic cleansing in their own homeland, Iran. But they're, sadly, it's a lovely community. I really like the Zoroastrians. But it's a very tiny community. It's just around 80,000, 100,000 in India, and that's the largest community that they have worldwide. But the Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, the Dharmic way, if you want to call it that, and its youngest cousin, religion, Sikhism, is still around. But we've adapted a lot, and in some ways, I feel at least, we've lost touch with what was special about our ancient way. I'm all for reform. You know, there is no one path which works forever. Yeah, as times change, you should adapt, right? But you must keep the best of what was there in your ancient times. And among those, in my opinion, are the way we looked at the relations between men and women. They were seen as equals. The inclusivity we had towards LGBTs. I'm sure you've heard of Lord Krishna, right? Who ISKCON worships. And of course, one of the most popular gods in India. The founder of Lord Krishna's clan, he comes from the clan called the Chandravanshis, the lunar dynasty. The founder of his clan was a transgender called Ila. She had founded the clan as a woman. She later became a man. She founded as a woman, but she later became a man. And this is the founder of the dynasty of one of our gods, right? It shows the attitude that India had. And these, I think, are worth preserving. And modern Indians also, at some levels, have forgotten about these things. Or we've been convinced that, oh, somehow this wasn't right. Maybe what the invaders told us about, you know, about our ancestors, maybe they were right. We need to ignore what the invaders said and go back to what our ancestors thought.
Is it a bit more problematic than that? So I'm thinking, I'm from Ireland, and I know that there was a fear when Irish legends and myths were being more celebrated in the 19th century, I guess. And since then, amongst people who'd come from Scotland, Britain, Protestants, I suppose, that maybe a resurgence of Catholic nationalism would mean they were no longer welcome. Mm. I suppose in India it could be if there's a resurgence of interest in ancient culture and heritage, that might mean Muslims felt that they weren't so welcome. And I know certainly where I'm from, there's a sensitivity about referring to people who maybe have lived there for generations and hundreds of years as settlers or invaders. And I imagine there might be similar sensitivities in India as well, if people have been living there for hundreds of years and their families, if they were being thought of as invaders, even if, right enough, that is originally how some groups of people came to the area.
Good question. And interesting, you should quote the example of Ireland. I don't want to get too deep into that because I know it's a sensitive issue. It's within the UK and you have a
well,
right to look at
well, it's certainly not all within the UK.
Ooh, I stepped on it already. Okay, I know many Irish, and particularly in the modern day, as Europe itself has got a lot more liberal and open, that they can differentiate between people today who they might get along with, but criticize invaders who did terrible harm to their ancestors. And you can kind of differentiate between the two. It would be a little unfair to tell the Irish that they must say that those who, in the particular people, the kings who invaded them, were great guys to prove their liberalism. That's unfair. But it's very fair to say that you can't blame today's English for what their ancestors may have done. And I think perhaps that's the conversation that's happening in India too. There is, even with the UK, a conversation that happens, because much of, till now, most of the interlocutors of Westerners, and including the UK, with India, were actually the Indian Anglicized elite, who live maybe in certain regions of Delhi, certain regions of Mumbai, Bangalore, Calcutta, that's it, Chennai. In the Indian Anglicized elite would not add up to more than maybe 20, 30 million people. It sounds like a lot, but in Indian terms, it's a drop in the bucket. The British are, for the first time perhaps, engaging with the real Indians now. And they get a little surprised when the real Indians say, there's no real shared history. And if there is, it's negative from our side. But we are pragmatic, we are willing to put it aside. But don't come to us and tell us we have a shared history. No, we don't, right? The Indian Anglicized elite never really told them that. It would be a similar thing to the Turkic invaders, and I'm very conscious I call them Turkic invaders. They were foreigners. 90%, 90-95% of Indian Muslims today are actually what are called Pasmanda Muslims, who are descendants of Indians who converted. And actually many of them sadly suffer oppression within their own communities because the leadership are all from what are called Ashraf Muslims, or descendants of the Turks. And this thing that Islam came to India only through invasions, it's true of North India, not true of all of India. The second or third oldest mosque in the world is actually in Kerala, in where it had come through traders, right? And many Indians, and some Indians saw it, and they took that up, but they continued with their old traditions as well. So it's kind of like a syncretic faith. And a vast majority of Indians across all groups tend to think this way. And this is not just a feeling, this is based on data. I'm sure you've heard of Pew surveys, among the best surveys in the world. They had done, they had come out with this survey a year and a half, 2 years back, on attitudes of religious groups within India. Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, right? Very interesting insights. Because they asked Hindus whether you'd be comfortable going to the worship place of another religion, mosque or church, or 90% said yes. They asked Muslims, do you believe in karma and dharma, which are actually Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, Sikh concepts? 88% said yes. Okay, they're Muslims, right? They asked Muslims and Christians that, do you believe that salvation or heaven is possible through another religion than yours? Guess how many said yes in India? I'm talking about Christians and Muslims. Close to 90%. You'd get a radically different answer in other countries. It shows the attitudes of all religious groups in India. Now, is there an extremist fringe in India across all religious groups? Yes, there are 1.4 billion of us, right? There are more people in India than all of North America, all of Europe, all of the Gulf countries combined. In 1.4 billion people, you will find a few thousand madmen, right? And if you search in all of North America, Europe and the Gulf countries, can you find, say, 500 drug smugglers? Yes, right? Then would it be fair to say all North Americans, all Europeans, all Gulf country guys are all drug smugglers? No, it's nonsense, right? So it's the same way with India too. Are there a few extremists? Yes. But you see in terms of violence per capita, you see in terms of, you go to different worship places. You can go to Haji Ali, Dargah, which is a tomb of a Muslim Sufi saint. You'll find, outside of a Friday, you'll find a majority of Hindus out there. You could go to Venkateshwara temple in South India. You find, and there are pictures of those that are, you can just Google them. There are women in burqas going and worshipping in a Hindu temple. That is India.
Well, I think that seems to be a suitable place to call end of part one. Come back in part two for more of the same.
More of the same with Amish and his book War of Lanka. With me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colgan.
On Weed Like a Word, Stephen, part two.